This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Moorish. Orthodox. Radio. Crusade. Anarchism for the global city. Radical environmentalism for the concrete jungle. Esoteric explorations of the secret history of rebel culture. The Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. Every Tuesday at midnight after the news, only on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. Be there.
Headlines.
Unrest in capital cities all across the world.
Anarchy. Anarchy. Anarchy.
Emma Goldman, anarchist, lived right here on Stanton Street and shouted, "Arise, arise."
Anarchy. Anarchy. Anarchy.
Going on in a fascist world.
Anarchy! Anarchy! Anarchy!
The death of Peter Kropotkin, 1929, Novodevichy Cemetery. His funeral was the last mass gathering of anarchists in Soviet Russia.
Voltairine de Cleyre, who said, "I do not think that one little bit of sensitive human flesh is worth all the property rights in New York City."
And more! And more!
Emma Goldman will still buy flowers for the love of beauty.
Anarchy! Anarchy! Anarchy!
For the general good, we might die. Anarchy! Anarchy! Anarchy!
Suicide on occasion, and less articulate.
Anarchy! Anarchy! Anarchy.
We appreciate all the ideas.
And some of the words.
Anarchy, 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 ah. Anarchy, anarchy, anarchy.
And
please, Jay, go ahead.
That is the prologue. That is the prologue from Red Noir, a new play by Anne Waldman, the poet whom we have right here in the studio with us, and directed by Judith Molina of the Living Theater, which is performing it at the Living Theater. And Judith is also with us.
You all are the Living Theater.
Yeah, we are the Living Theater. We're living, and we are definitely theater.
Or a chunk thereof. There are other members who are not present tonight, but
there
many
are
of you
many
are.
On more than one continent. Judith?
Yes. We are very happy. We're very happy to be doing this particular play because its theme is very close to our heart. It's actually a sort of detective thriller based on the film noir. And that's all about the corruption and the violence and the rottenness in this world. And so we present an ensemble of 20 anarchists who are trying to find a better way to organize life and the world than the one in which the corruption of the film noir wallows. We have a...
And in which we ourselves are inevitably mired, even as we try this.
All the time. We can't get out of it until everybody's out of it. There's no individual liberation. We gotta either make a revolution, or I don't know. Or we're gonna blow up the world. So we better.
You have just zeroed in on the fundamental flaw of New Age thinking.
How so?
The notion that nobody's liberated until we all are, and that we are we live in social context. And that positive thinking and creative visualization and individualistic solutions are ultimately illusory.
In the play, we take a thing called the Bodhisattva vow, mm-hmm. where we all vow not to ourselves be or feel liberated until everyone is.
There you go.
And I'm sure they'll elaborate on that better than I could.
Okay, so it's called Red Noir, which literally means black white. I suppose you could call
black,
it
red black.
Black red.
Yeah.
You could call it
red black.
Rouge black, I suppose. Yeah. But that's a reference to the whole film noir genre. I take it. In fact, the subtitle is a detective thriller.
Yes, we should ask this of Anne Waldman, the author. This is actually based on, a book of her poetry, also called Red Noir, that this was adapted from by Judith. And I should say, for those of you who don't know or have misplaced the file in your mind, Anne, among many other things, and the beatniks out there know who she is, but for the rest of you, she is, among many other things, the co-founder with her dear friend Allen Ginsberg of the Jack Kerouac Institute for Disembodied Poetics at the Naropa Institute.
In Colorado.
Yes. So, yeah, you know, she leaped right up when you made your New Age crack. So, anyway, Anne, yeah, can you deal with what this all means
well,
for the detective thriller?
It was interesting to use the noir tropes. You know, they're two sisters. They're two sort of corrupted agents. There's an agent of green. There's a mysterious Doc, who seems to control everything, and you're living in this ambiguous realm of double dealing, and yet there's wonderful, you know, possibility and potential and interesting energy in these characters, and the actors portray them beautifully. But there's also a grandmother and her child, a black woman with a white child, so there's an interracial theme as well, and they are in their laboratory, their dream laboratory, their study, their library, and they're reading Frederick Douglass to one another together, and that's a sort of theme in the play. So there's a little noir in that in the invocation of Douglass, and then there's red, as in red.
As in
red. Yes.
Red as in communists, as opposed to red as in red states.
Or socialists, or socialists. Even the social-minded anarchists.
Yes.
Or
yes.
Red's a very popular color in Buddhism. It's the sort of Padma realm of energy and seduction and magnetizing. So, you know, there's a play with the colors. And then there's a green theme, which comes in out of into the mix. And it was very interesting for me to have this coming up against the extraordinary ethos of the Living Theater, which, of course, is, radical, revolutionary, environmentally hip and aware, and, themselves. I mean, Judith as the great archivist. So the archive, I'm very curious and interested in the sense of archive that we need to be keeping that library, that study going, reading our texts, and keeping mentally awake, and continuing that sense of the for the consciousness of the future, so that people will know we weren't just slaughtering each other in these times.
George Santayana said that those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it.
Yep.
And we're trying to avoid that. There is, in fact, an attempt to prolong the past into the future through these the seed banks that play a role in this play.
Hmm. Right, which ties into the green theme. Do you want to elaborate on that a little bit? Somebody?
The green is the hopeful solution that we can save our situation even at this late date, even in the emergency that we're in with the global warming, with 30,000 more men into Afghanistan. That's today's news.
Yep.
So that in a way, we want to counter all that. We want to push against this dire fate. And green stands for the ecologically pure, the effort to continue the hopeful growth, even in dire times.
And it's also such a common word used that everyone can understand. It's also such a common word used that everyone can understand. And especially for a younger generation, when you say green living, it's something that everyone can automatically say, oh, green, I know. But when you're looking at it at a broader sense, which is what this is doing too, to look at it at a broader sense of green living in every aspect of living.
Mm-hmm. That's Laurie Summer, by the way, for any comedy fans out there who might recognize her from a different context. And we should maybe, if anybody else speaking up at any point, can, you know, tell everybody who they are, because, you know, we're all family here.
Mm-hmm.
So this is currently playing, opens December 10th, actually. So
right.
It's going to open in a week.
Yes.
Yes. So we're deep into dress rehearsals, and we're all in a kind of hysterical exhaustion right now. We just come from a wonderful rehearsal where everything was going very well, what with all the problems that come up in any dress rehearsal. And we're full of the enthusiasm of our struggle.
Well, if this is you in a state of exhaustion, I'd hate to see you when you're bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. So this is playing at the Living Theater in your own space, which is where?
21 Clinton Street. It's right off House Street and easy to find. And we will be performing Wednesdays, Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays, right through January.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we are prohibited from mentioning how much it costs, but I will say that it's not quite twice what you would pay for a movie in Manhattan.
Yeah,
that
very
a fair characterization?
Reasonable. Yes, a Wednesday night, by the way, in keeping with our long-term project to abolish money, is pay what you like night.
Right. But the other nights are not, because your landlord, unfortunately,
right,
is not down with the whole long-term project of abolishing money.
Right, or the holders of his mortgage are not.
Yes,
we have a very friendly landlord,
but
you know,
we can't pay them what we want.
Yeah.
And it's actually so beautifully worth it, because you receive so much more that it's, if you were to put a monetary price tag on it, it's, people should be paying so much more. What people pay for and what they receive is
often not.
There's words that I'm not allowed to say.
Yes, there's a list
there's a violation of words that I cannot use.
And they are enlisted in the order that George Carlin gave them in his famous monologue, which this very station took to the Supreme Court and lost.
Lost, yes, exactly.
But it is so beautifully worth it.
So, Anne Waldman, this yes. began as a poem and then developed into a play, or
no? Actually, it was
work?
A play. Mm-hmm. The Red Noir with the characters, and it was somewhat of, you know, I saw it as a bit parodic and using a little bit of the device in the noir thriller Kiss Me Deadly. There's a suitcase with something strange in it. And then there are other texts in this collection, and Judith very brilliantly took some of the poems and created a chorus that are there as a you know, they're witnesses, they're the conscience of the situation, of the larger situation, of the macrocosm. They move and morph and shape things and guide us through. So, you know, I see this as a collaboration with her brilliant intuition, her theatrical intuition. So it was a germ, in a way, of a play with these characters and some monologues. And then I was able to create, you know, as we worked together, created more text for some of them.
What Judith has managed to do amazingly as well is the original play that Anne wrote was just for the characters of the detective show.
Right.
And Judith has managed to integrate an ensemble of almost 20 people, which is quite powerful to be involved in a rehearsal process in a production that has that many people on a stage and that many voices. And we do a lot of vocal work in the show, and to have that as a backdrop and an underlay to the action of the detective plot is something quite spectacular.
Yes. That's Ruby Glaskin, by the way, who's our indispensable factotum in this play, and how we are going to continue on when she goes back across the pond in a week or so, I don't know. But
factotum.
Thank you.
Doer of all jobs, yes.
All right, so when was it actually written?
2008, 2007, maybe 2007 started, and then it came out in a little edition in 2008, but had not been performed. And Judith had been asking me kept saying when I'd see her, do you have a play? And I remember being with Peter Lamborn Wilson, and I said, well, come on, let's do it. You know, let's compete. Who can get the play ready first? So I gave her a copy of Red Noir, and Hannon was still alive, and he read it. And then they called, and they said, we like it. We have some questions. And then she wanted to know, what are the motivations here? What are these, you know, what do I tell my actors?
Hannon in question is Hannon Reznikoff.
Yes.
Yes.
Who died, what, about a year ago?
Just over a year and a half ago now, May of 2008, mm-hmm. Alas. Very great loss to us.
But still inspires us.
Very much, very much. Mm-hmm. Every day, literally, every day.
So I wasn't aware that Peter Lamborn Wilson was working on a play for the Living Theatre.
He's going to come in next week, and I'm going to, you know, nudge him a little.
You know, I've been asking Peter for a play for years.
Well, you know that he's the founder and hierophant emeritus of this radio show.
Yes, yes. Yes.
We know that. Well, we're well aware of that. Well aware. That's part of the draw. Yeah, it's not... Shall we do a musical interlude for a moment? A brief, Lori, what should we go do now?
I don't know. What shall we all do?
How about Azura?
Azura. Okay, this is the Azura Waltz. And I, if somebody had told me 2 months ago that in 2 months I would be saying, oh, today we did a large amount of work on the waltz, wouldn't that? I never would have believed them, but that I would be happy about it.
Azura?
Really, yes, it's my favorite part of the play. Mm-hmm. This is, do you want to explain this beforehand, or should we just do the
waltz? Why don't we just sing it first,
right.
And maybe there'll be some questions.
Yes.
Okay.
Azura, blue moon, forbidden fruit, Mary, Juanita, light of Jah, Azura, blue moon, forbidden fruit, Mary, Juanita, light of Jah, Azura, blue moon, forbidden fruit, Mary, Juanita, light of Jah, Azura, blue moon, forbidden fruit, Mary, Juanita, light of Jah.
And you want to explain what that means? What it's all about.
Listeners of this program, it's some beautiful language strung together and becomes very symbolic of the, you know, the keep it moving other suitcase belonging to Bolt, our runner, who's
moving things into the seed bank.
We have two suitcases who are in some way the inanimate stars of the show. One contains some sort of a ticking, frightening nuclear device. And the other contains the seeds of the future, which we want to preserve and bring to fruit. These are the Azura, etc., are the names of certain seeds that raise the spirits.
Yeah. Yes. I don't believe I'm familiar with this word, though, surprisingly. A-Z-U-R-A.
It's one particular variety, yes. For those, by the way, of your noir fan listeners who find the bomb in the suitcase at all familiar, it is, in fact, from the 1955 movie Kiss Me Deadly. Cloris Leachman's movie debut, by the way, where she shows up naked at the very beginning in a trench coat, wearing a trench coat and nothing else, running barefooted along the highway and gets picked up by Mike Hammer in a car. So this is, in fact, in the 60-odd years that Judith has been doing the this kind of theater, the first one that's been inspired by a Mickey Spillane novel.
But you've added the suitcase full of seeds.
Yes. Well, we have
we try to outbalance the evil with the good. It's part of our indefatigable optimism that we pursue. And in the end, I think we will win. And somehow the two suitcases moving across the theatrical space, actually running around the theatrical space, because we surround the audience with what we call a runaround, which is a kind of stage that encloses the audience. Our interest has always been to include our audiences in our performance, and in the second part of this performance the audience does perform with us together. That's part of the empowerment that goes with anarchism, that we don't have two classes, one of which is silent and one of which speaks, one of which is in the light and one of which is in the dark. So we like to grab the audience and say, come with us, sing with us, act with us. And we do manage to do that here. And when the beneficent suitcase is opened, we all manage to include everybody.
It was interesting. Judith had the idea of the runaround fairly early on from the beginning. I remember when she first showed me the drawing, and there's a way that the chorus, the anarchy chorus, holds the space. So it's an incredibly wonderful container, and there's this very hospitable environment with the runaround. There's a lot of action on it.
It was great. All of us Living Theatre members who were hanging around the theatre, we knew in the very beginning that there was going to be a runaround. And the script was not quite made yet, but we were all so excited just with the set alone and Anne's original work. It was really exciting to see it come to fruition.
That's cool. Erin Downhour.
Ciao. Yeah.
So the anarchist chorus are more sort of removed from the plot in the role of observers or commentators?
Well, we are...
Blend with it.
Yes, we blend with it. We interact with it entirely. The characters come out and interact with us. Really, this runaround represents, I think, the streets, the block. It's the people walking around the block.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I think of it, in fact, as being Houston, Clinton, Stanton, and Rivington Streets, which surround, in fact, our theater, which is on Clinton Street.
Yes, yes.
And there's much going on the block, including a protest against animal abuse at the supermarket by a character who goes and lies down to stop people from going in and buying meat. There's all kinds of us people who are those who are trying to change this system, and at the same time those who are mired in this system and the victims of this system and sometimes the perpetrators of this system, wandering about not sure whom to trust and
we
what
all
to
sort
do.
Of wear all of those hats at various times in our lives,
don't we? And now we get to do it on stage and eventually bring the audience into it, too.
But the runaround also represents everywhere. It doesn't just represent the streets of the neighborhood, it represents streets everywhere.
The word
of
on the
every
street,
right of every neighborhood, of wherever you are, and of people everywhere. And that's what we represent all people.
At times, it's very samsaric. So the wheel, the endless wheel of suffering, the meat wheel, and so on. There's a, you know, times when it kind of shifts its dimension.
Mm-hmm. And the protest at the supermarket reaches its climax with the police carrying away the demonstrator, something many living theater hands have had Fintuis in real life many a time. Yes, and Judith was telling us of the 12 countries she's been arrested in recently. But at the same time, the noir plot reaches a certain climax then continues on with or takes a twist into a whole another noir plot.
Yeah, morphs into another... reality.
So. Okay, but it actually has got a fairly linear plot that one can follow.
To be decided.
Several, I would say. several linear plots intertwining.
Simultaneous things going on with the grandmother and her study and the Ruby character who's played by the fabulous Sheila Dabney. She's got her own kind of realm there. And then you have these two agents of good and bad out on the street.
The two suitcase carriers.
The two suitcase carriers, yes. Very elegant suitcases.
Sheila was supposed to be with us tonight and is under the weather, alas. We had planned for her to lead us, which she does. She's brilliant.
Oh, she's brilliant.
And she's making up the music as she goes along by playing her instrument and figuring it out, and we are the instrument, and it's a great experience. So we're very lucky that Laurie could come tonight and take over that.
Well,
so
we're all doing it. I will not take credit. Thank you, Jay, but I will also give props to everyone here because...
Yes, that's
true. Dina, Aaron,
and
Brent, Martin, Enoch, Ruby.
Thank you.
Have we got everyone? Okay.
And now that my name's been announced, I might say about the runaround, I'm Martin.
That's Martin.
Martin. The runaround for me has brought me out into the streets, just talking to people, going to clubs and dances and striking up conversations that I wouldn't normally do because I take the play with me.
Absolutely.
That's one thing that
absolutely.
I do.
Absolutely. Just this morning, I got a subway car singing. It was great.
Yes,
no,
and
you
look
take
at,
it away with you for sure.
And I look at people now on the street, you know, and I'm observing all of the ways that people really do act and bringing that back into the play, and you know, more conscious also of my own actions on the street, which somewhat resemble my actions in the play. I'm usually walking down reading something, and
right, because every time when I know for me when I leave and just experiencing the street now. At any given point, I'm always saying it's the runaround. Anytime I leave the theater and walking down the street, it's the runaround. I encounter anyone, whether it be on the subway or it's the runaround. Any weird character, and especially living in New York City, it's a constant runaround.
It certainly is.
It's a constant.
It's
runaround.
A constant runaround, and I think that that's why I say that the runaround is. It doesn't just have to be city streets. It could be anyone who comes from anywhere in the world or anywhere in America, their runaround could be a mall. The runaround could be a doctor's office. It could be because you encounter characters, you encounter other living beings, you encounter beautiful people or sketchy people, or where you're always looking over your shoulder, or you know, you encounter that in every walk of life. So the runaround is exactly that. It's everywhere.
And there are moments where the anarchist chorus ceases to walk around just as if they were on the street, and you see that we can all come together spontaneously at any time and decide to unite and say all those things that people are really thinking deep down, you know, put an end to trouble. Everyone knows that they'd love to put an end to trouble, but people don't realize that they can unite. And I think that there's moments in the play where we all snap out of our you know, everyday actions that we're taking, and we come together in a song or in a chant of some kind, and say all those things that people are thinking deep down, all these anarchist thoughts that run naturally through everyone's mind, even if they don't realize that they are an anarchist. That's just the good in people, and it comes out. And yeah, that's all for me.
Well, the Trouble Stomp is a good example of, yeah, you know, one moment where everybody comes together, and one of the characters is, you know, the monologue builds, and she's on the word trouble, everybody stomps in unison.
This is the grandmother, Mrs. Elder, who is played magnificently by Viney Burroughs, whose
great
Broadway
actress.
Career alone goes back to the 50s, and who couldn't be here with us tonight. More power to her, because she's getting up early tomorrow to be in court in support of Lynn Stewart.
Ah, really?
Yes.
In what capacity?
I was actually so busy organizing this, I didn't go into the details. Hmm. I just wished the cause luck.
Because it's my understanding she's already been sentenced and turned herself in, and I didn't think there was any more courtroom
stuff. The New York Post might have told you that.
Viney is an old political hand as well as an old Broadway hand, so I don't know what she's actually doing there, but sure, she's doing the right thing, I'm sure.
Well, just for justice or injustice or just justice for all, I think that was a part of it.
Yes. I want to say that the whole show that we are doing, it's an experiment.
Don't touch the mic. Don't touch the mic. Okay.
Our play, it's an experiment. It's a new experience every day, because the audience is going to be involved in the play. And every day the runaround is different. Every day we develop new things. We come up with other things. So I guess every night the show is going to be different, and it's going to be a new experiment, which is great.
And it will be, especially with an audience that will eventually, as always with the Living Theater, and perhaps even more than usual, have to enter into this action where we have our main characters, but just as we have in real life, our characters, ourselves, who are rooted in and entwined in this larger world, this runaround world that we're in of New York and of the world. And we have our lives and our stories rooted in that, and the audience eventually, not only do the characters intertwine with us and interact with us and join and leave us, but eventually the audience will as well in some way or other.
So it's like snowflakes. No two are alike. No two performances are alike.
So come twice.
Yes, because you're part of the cast.
All right. And once again, I should say that it is now 12:32 in the morning on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI. 99.5 FM in New York City. This is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. My name is Bill Weinberg, and we are speaking with the Living Theater, who are presenting Anne Waldman's Red Noir, a detective thriller. I will add, an anarchist detective thriller, apparently.
Yes.
As directed by Judith Molina, who is joining us tonight, along with Anne Waldman and various other members of the Living Theater. Do you guys want to perform a little more, and then we'll talk a little bit about the history of the Living Theater? Who and what is the Living Theater?
The new tree night for us.
Through into the toxic dirge.
So we'll go around, starting from Enoch.
Toxic dirge. That sounds good.
We're starting from Enoch and going this way.
Fits my cheery disposition.
All right, let's see if we can find our pages in the 20. All right. What is happening leading into this is that there has been simultaneous with the carrying off of the final carrying off of the protester, who's been lying in between two cops across the runaround to the other side of the street or world where there is the jail for her. There is the confrontation between the two hard-boiled detectives in this play, one of whom is played by Sheila Dabney, our musical director as well.
Four-time Obie Award winner, Sheila Dabney, and for those who are keeping score.
Right. Okay. And for those who are keeping score, how many do you have, Judith? Obie?
Exactly. How many?
Eight, I think.
Okay.
So more arrests than Obies.
Yes. More countries. Just like never mind arrests. More countries she's been arrested in than Obies. But
okay.
So here we are, and there's been this final confrontation and a shooting. I won't tell you who shoots whom, but now we go into the last.
Wait, could I also add of the course that we're about to do, the neutrino course, and how this was also in a very popular film right now, who has also
2012, they stole this.
They stole this. And saying exactly what we're saying, but we are also doing it in a more beautiful way, being pacifist anarchists.
All right, shall we? The dying character's final line is, in fact, invest in neutrinos.
Elementary particles called neutrinos are said to pass us with the speed of light.
Most neutrinos passing through the Earth emanate from the Sun.
More than 50 trillion solar electron neutrinos pass through the human body every day. Eno, the Italian suffix, indicates a small object.
It is possible that the neutrino and anti-neutrino are in fact the same particle. The neutrino could transform into an anti-neutrino and vice versa by flipping the orientation of its spin state. And neutrinos are a metaphor for what travels invisible without baggage through interstellar space.
They are sometimes called ghosts. What is the message in the human realm?
To be small. Invisible.
Do no harm.
It's toxic. Toxic. Toxic.
Do no harm.
Like the end of the world.
Aerosol sprays, aircraft noise, arsenic, automobile
like
exhaust.
Like the end of the world.
Benzene, beryllium, carbon dioxide,
like
carbon tetrachloride.
End of the world.
Carcinogens, chlorodane, chlorobenzene, chromium.
Like the end of
you
the world.
You say coal, smoke, dichloride, DDT, dieldrin dioxide.
Like the end of
endosulfane,
ethane. Ethylene glycol, ethylene oxide.
Like the end. Pain.
The Nox,
like
prop,
the
ethyl,
end
fluorocarbons, fungicides, gasolines.
World. Like the
Eptichlor, herbicides, hydrocarbons, industrial particulate matter, isonuric acid, lead paint. Lactophone.
Like the end.
Mercury, mining waste.
Napalm, nitrous compounds. Noise.
Like the
nuclear waste.
Power quash dichloride. Parisian pesticides.
Like
radionuclides.
End of the world.
Sewage sludge, sulfur oxides, tobacco smoke, toxic waste, ultraviolet radiation,
like
vinyl chloride,
wood smoke
rising.
Or reading the world as a chemical book is toxic, toxic, toxic.
Do no harm.
Or reading the world as a chemical book is toxic, toxic, toxic.
Do no harm.
Did I detect strains of the Gigantor theme there?
I don't know. Did
you'll
you?
Have to ask Sheila what her influences are. I thought it might have been Tchaikovsky myself. That may. Oh well, there maybe we should ask the poet. That's a coincidence or no?
I don't know what she went her.
No, the phrase "end of the world" was not intended to be a reference to Gigantor.
No. The actual musical name, Gigantor. Remember that when you were a kid?
Very vaguely.
Research back to the lab.
Okay.
Sheila has an amazing way of using her voice, which most of us can only ever imitate. But, and when she came out with that, I think all of our jaws dropped. And it was like she was just yawning and this massive sound was coming out of her mouth.
Like the end of the world.
You'll just have to come. I mean, Glory's doing a great job, but you should really come and hear the way it comes out.
Yeah,
in that
she's actually... I mean, the same way that Bobby McFerrin used to be, like, such an instrument with his body. I mean, like, Sheila is just such a... She's a whole ensemble, a whole orchestra of just being a composer, and the way she hears music and melodies and sounds and what she's able to bring out just by reading the words and reading the script and just what she's able to bring out of everyone. Everyone that wasn't singers or could sing a little bit and what she's brought out of everybody is just phenomenal. And she's made this whole piece into a beautiful music that I feel like we could almost do an album. I keep saying that I'm going to come out with an album called Container of Steel, and which is another thing that maybe a couple of us can do. We could do the chorus. I mean, we're here. Right, we could do that maybe later too. But I mean, she's really done just such a magnificent job.
And also her own role. She's quite extraordinary.
Yeah, there's a lot of that going on in this play, actually, in the principal actors, I have to say. As long as we're mentioning what a great, incredible jobs people have done, we have a dance teacher. It's somebody whose day job, you know, is actually dance instruction in our cast, in our theater, in the Living Theater now, who has done some remarkable work. She's the one who actually turned me into someone who not only can waltz but enjoys it as the favorite part of the play, and that is quite a miracle. Jenna Kirk has done that. And I should mention now, for those who are just tuning in, perhaps, I'm Jay Dobkin here with Judith Molina, Anne Waldman, the Living Theater, which is going on with a play that Anne has written, Red Noir, a detective thriller, directed by Judith Molina, a founder of the Living Theater 60-some-odd years ago and still going strong.
Going strong.
And it's going to be from December 10th all the way through January 30th, Wednesdays through Saturdays, for dollars at the Living Theater at 21 Clinton Street, just below Houston Street, Houston Street. You see, I've lived in New York all my life. I never believed I would ever do that. What Judith said about us all being something about our brains being fried, but much more eloquent at the beginning is absolutely true. The exhaustion of hysterical exhaustion or something. I cannot believe that I did that.
As long as you don't say Avenue.
Born and raised.
As long as you don't say Avenue of the Americas.
Yes, no, that I don't think I could do that at this hour after the amount of sleep I'm working on and the minimal amounts of sleep and not enough coffee, even worse. And yet here we are with this thing opening, as I say, at the Living Theater, which is at 21 Clinton Street. And, of course, you should go to livingtheater.org, and that's theater spelled theatry with an R-E at the end.
The English way.
Yes, www.livingtheater with an R-E at the end, .org. And there will, of course, be lots of information there about how to come. And, again, Wednesday night is Pay What You Like night, in keeping with the spirit of not really liking capitalism or money.
Mm-hmm.
Just having to be mired in it, as I say, and caught up in it and victimized by it and even occasionally perpetrated on
yes.
others who come to
all
be
all of us simultaneously audience. Playing those different roles.
We should mention the other principals as well.
Yes, let's do that, please.
As there's well, because they are
Viney Burroughs, as we said, plays Grandmother Elder. Mrs. Elder, Sheila Dabney, the hard-boiled detective Ruby, and Anthony Sisko, who got a raven tattooed on his arm when he was playing Edgar Allan Poe in the Living Theater's Eureka. That's commitment. Anthony Sisko has now shaved the Poe mustache he had been wearing and is playing the other hard-boiled detective, Ruby's ex, carrying around the suitcase with the apparently nuclear bomb or something really nasty in it like that. It is called Jelly. Eno Edette plays his counterpart, Bolt, the running man, with the good suitcase full of seeds for the future of all kinds of wonderful plants. And Camila de Araujo, I'm assuming that's Araujo. You know, I've known Camila since she was a toddler, literally, and I should have asked her that. But she is now 14 years old and grown up to be in the Living Theater and playing somebody, the child of a Living Theater.
Second generation Living Theater person.
Right. Okay. And an old friend of my daughter who is many the time found the Afikoman with her at the Living Theater Seder.
And Judith.
Judy Reimer as well.
Yes, let's go on. I'm sorry, Judy Reimer. You know, I'm leading this thing, as I say, frazzled. Judy Reimer, who has been now, was in the Living Theater when I showed up 12 years ago one day to tape a performance and somehow never left. And had been, she's now literally half her life, she was saying recently. She started at 19, and it's been 19 years. And she's got another Living Theater baby now, toddler. And
she plays Crystal.
Right, and while I'm at it, we have here in the studio from the ensemble, Enoch Wu.
Enoch.
Yes, okay.
Enoch, like knock knock with an E, man.
Okay, Enoch Wu. Martin, it says Munoz here. Is that,
Munoz,
I was assuming, for M-U-N-O-Z. Martin Munoz, Erin Downauer, Lori Summer, and Ondina Frate. And who else is here tonight? I'm looking at this instead of behind me. Brent Barker, yes. I'm trying to read their names and a whole other. And while I'm at it, let me tell you that this is also with Ruby, of course, whose name is not on here. How terrible. You should be credited for all your wonderful work.
Totally.
Ruby Glaskin is in the studio with us, filling in, as always, for many of these lines.
Okay.
So should we talk more about the play or anarchy or...
Well, all of the above. This is your first work since The Brig, or you did one in between?
I did some stuff in between.
Some stuff in between.
We did a play that was written, really, by Helen Resnikov called...
Eureka.
Called Eureka.
Based on Edgar Allan Poe's last book, which was about the Big Bang, strangely enough, although most people didn't have the theory yet.
Really?
It was itself based on a book by Alexander von Humboldt, whose statue, of course, whose bust, at least, is across from the Museum of Natural History at 77th Street, for those who want to track down these little New York trivia statuary moments.
We literally reenacted the Big Bang in the middle of our theater space with the whole audience and ensemble.
But much safer than the original.
So let me just briefly recapitulate. I'm sure I got this straight. Edgar Allan Poe wrote something called Eureka, which anticipated the Big Bang and was somehow based on the works of Alexander von Humboldt.
Yes, if you can find it online, go look it up online. That's it's all the text is there.
I'm surprised this is news to me, but I confess it is.
Perhaps because it's such impenetrable writing.
That was a very special play for me because it was the first play after 60 years of trying in which I managed to get every member of the audience to perform from beginning to end, because when they came in, there were no seats, there was no place to sit down, there was no other context except participation. And everybody participated, even the Times reviewer put down her notebook and performed, which is pretty
Indeed.
Rare.
Wow.
That's
quite a coup.
I'm sorry, yes, that was a coup. But the idea, I mean, I'm a student of Erwin Piscator, who together with Bertolt Brecht pretty much invented modern political theater. And I have tried through his influence all my life to deepen and further the audience's role in the play. And this was, Eureka was the first time that I, that we could do it from beginning to end with everybody who came in performed from beginning to end. And that was a very important moment for me of breaking through the two-class system in the theater in which the audience is the audience and the performers are the performers, and the performers classically feel themselves in some way superior, but actually have really only one advantage, which is also a disadvantage, namely that we've prepared and they haven't prepared, and we think that preparation makes us better at it than the spontaneous audience. But on the other hand, we're an affinity group, and the audience is everybody, and the audience has a much wider range of input than we could possibly have, because we don't contain all the various colorations of ideology or philosophy or poetry that the audience contains. So the liberation of the audience as a really creative force has been something we've been striving for 60 years now. And it's a very important part of it.
Wow,
it's
60 years.
65 years, I think, we've been going now.
Isn't that called the fourth wall in theater terms, the barrier between the audience and the performer? Have I got that right?
Oh, no, we got rid of that early.
You'll be lucky if we let you keep your seat in this play. You think I'm joking? Oh, I realize I left off one of the performers who's in the studio. I guess when I looked around, I didn't notice him. That's me, Jay Donovan.
Yes, of course.
Okay. I knew I was here. I figured I was here somewhere.
Oh, so when did you perform The Brig? That was not too long ago, right?
Well, we performed it first 30 years ago.
Yes, exactly.
And then we performed
45, I think.
I
45, 1964, right, or 63.
I have no numbers. I don't know.
But you last performed it two years ago, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And this time the IRS didn't shut it down at
CCF. Yes, and in fact, you won a bunch of Obies for it.
Yes, we did. Everybody in it won an Obie. And it was a large cast, and we all won Obies. And it was a very important moment, because after 30 years, I sat down with the playwright, and we said, well, it's 30 years later. Let's see what we want to change, bring up to date, modernize. And we couldn't find a word we wanted to change. Hmm. And we did exactly the same text, and actually the same actions, because it's about the same action that goes on. It's about the military discipline that informs our society, and the military discipline is very strict and very ancient. It goes back to, if you look at the walls of the ancient monuments, you see the soldiers marching in the same step and with the same conformity, and the discipline of the military is part of our schooling, it's part of our educational force, and it hasn't changed.
Well, the play goes beyond military discipline. I mean, it sort of portrays torture and political sadism.
The only torture in the play, the only torture in the play, is a punch in the stomach, and
a ritual humiliation, at least.
There is lots of humiliation.
Psychological torture.
Yes.
But but there is no torture. The torture is a punch in the belly. But it seems like torture because of the conformity. Mm-hmm. The torture is, and it is a very Artaudian torture for the actors who stand at absolute attention and read the Marine Corps manual from beginning to end and cannot move a finger or an eyelash without being punished. The conformity, the rigidity, that's the torture. The torture isn't waterboarding or some kind of mechanical device. Mm. It's only It's only rigidity and conformity to the nth degree. And it has a very strong effect on the audience watching it.
So the first time you performed this was about the time I was being born, sometime in the early 1960s.
Yes.
And you were pretty much in blatant retaliation, shut down by the IRS.
Yes. And clear retaliation. There was a big stink made about our criticizing the United States Marine Corps, which was not to be criticized. And we were accused of not paying taxes, which we in fact had paid, and went through a big fancy federal trial for 13 days of courtroom theater. Mm-hmm. Courtroom theater all the way. And, you know, the courtroom is a stage, and we consider ourselves competent in stagecraft, and we used the courtroom for that purpose, and it was finally proved that we did not owe those taxes. In fact, there's a dollar in escrow in some lawyer's office because we didn't owe those taxes. But I did 30 days in jail for contempt of court. Hmm. And rightly so. I was pretty contemptuous of the court.
And you lost your space at that time.
Lost our space at that time.
Did you get it back when you were exonerated?
No, we went on 30 years of touring around Europe. Mm-hmm. And every few years we'd come back to New York and do some of the plays that we created in Europe. Actually, Europe is more hospitable to us than the United States. In Europe, we could even make a living. Here, we just about have to scraggle through being able to continue our existence, and our existence is always in peril.
Yes.
Because the United States doesn't really honor artistic experiment in the same way. But with a little hubris, I like to say Europe loves us, but New York needs us.
So where was that original space?
That was on 14th Street, but that was one of...
on the west side?
14th Street and 6th Avenue. Yeah.
Yes, you had quite a theatrical night the night it closed. If you want to tell that story.
We had a week of street demonstrations in which we refused to leave the theater, and we were surrounded by police on horses, and people brought up food by... in baskets on ropes.
Wow.
And finally, the feds broke in and carried us out by the ankles and shoulders, and took us from the theatrical jail of the Brig to the real jail.
Talk about life imitating art, huh?
Yes, it was. It was a noble journey.
So then you were on the road in Europe for how many years? A lot of years.
Oh, I don't know numbers, but yeah. on and off 30
South America
years.
A bit. South America.
So this began your career of getting arrested in 12 different countries around the world. Do you want to name them? Can you rattle them off for us? How many countries?
Oh, let's see. France, Germany, Spain, Italy. I don't know them all.
Oh, well, let's say the U.S., Brazil.
Yes.
What did you just mention? France, Germany, Spain, Italy, Sweden, you told us.
Sweden, yes.
Greece.
We were even busted in Sweden. That's
shocking.
Greece, I believe you said, also the Netherlands and Belgium.
Right. My goodness, you know.
The U.K., was that one of them or no?
Yes,
the U.K. And what was the other? Austria. There you go. Austria, Germany, U.K., France, Belgium, the Netherlands, Sweden, Greece, Spain, Italy, the U.S., and Brazil are the 12 countries in which Judith has been arrested.
Okay, well, at this time, Spain and Greece were military dictatorships, so I guess it wasn't that hard to get arrested. But how did you manage to get arrested in Sweden and the Netherlands?
Usually by insisting on our rights. In Sweden, we wanted to eat after the show, and we went to a restaurant that was called Night Workers Restaurant, and we insisted that since our show ended at 11 o'clock that we deserved to eat in a night workers restaurant, and they said no, actors don't eat here, and we sat down and they came in and busted us.
Actors don't eat here.
That's the flip side of that class system between the actors and the audience.
Yes.
Go out into the real world and it may turn around on you.
Right.
But you had some pretty nightmarish experiences when you were arrested in Brazil.
Well, Brazil was at that time a military dictatorship. And we came to Brazil when all the experimental theaters had been closed. All the small theaters had been closed. The great opposing camp even sent in people into Zeselso's theater, for instance, where they came and they beat up the audience. And then the theater was closed for public safety. But the people that beat up the audience instigated it, and they were in cahoots with the cops. We went there because there was no other possibility for them, and we said we'd try. And we worked almost a year and a half before they caught us. They caught us for doing a Mother's Day play, of all things, in which we suggested rebellious acts. And it was a terrible experience because our companions in the prison were being tortured daily.
And what were you actually arrested for? Wasn't there some planted marijuana or something
there
like that?
There was some planted marijuana right in our garden.
Not like planted marijuana right. Seeds, like yes, planted on them and they planted
it.
In
a plastic bag.
Provocateur.
It was a plastic bag and it was put there by the cops, and it was dug up by the cops with a very funny photograph of a police dog sniffing at our wall under a sign that said, look, with an arrow pointing downward.
Look in English, by the way.
Look
not
in English.
Not Beja.
Which we thought was a huge joke. And it became a kind of a joke because the trial went on week after week. And every day we came from where we lived, Urupreto, to Belo Horizonte, where we were tried, and every day they opened the package, the plastic bag, and every time there was a lot less of in it.
What a surprise.
Brazilian police.
It was always a little howl of laughter from the court, from the spectators. Because the evidence kept diminishing, and we didn't get any of that.
You were busted in Rio or elsewhere?
In Uruguay, too, and which is Belo Horizonte.
Belo Horizonte, the capital of Minas Gerais, a big mining state in Brazil, kind of a sort of a Pennsylvania or Kentucky or something of Brazil, and.
So how long were you held for, and how did that escapade end?
About 72 days, and we were with the best people in Brazil, because the best people in Brazil were offering resistance at the time, and it was a real wonderful bunch of people, and very inspiring. And when we left there, we said, look, we have no money, but we're being expelled. We're being expelled by a presidential decree, because we got the, we got the cultural people all to send letters, to the president, and the president asked, why do I get a letter from Jean-Paul Sartre? What is this? And someone explained to him it was the Living Theater, and he said, get them out of here.
Ah, so you were neither convicted nor acquitted then?
No, we were neither, neither really, in Brazil. But when we left, we said to our comrades in the jail, what can we do for you? We can't send you money. And they said, show them, tell them what's happening to us. And that was the origin of our play, Seven Meditations on Political Sadomasochism,
yes.
In which we demonstrated some of the tortures and some of the mistreatment that went on in Brazil.
And you performed that in the United States,
in
Europe,
both? In the United
States
and in Europe for several years.
Mm-hmm. So, and yet you managed to get into Brazil when and Spain and Greece when they were all under military dictatorships, even if you got into some trouble there.
Well, we can show good reviews of our plays, and if somebody doesn't know the other side of it, they can usually, you know, we slipped in. I mean, you have to be a little subversive.
Yes. Yes. So you recently landed back in New York City and opened your space, which is at...
2.5 years now we've been there, right?
21 Clinton Street.
21 Clinton Street, between Houston and Rivington. Stanton, right, Stanton.
Houston and Stanton.
That's the Living Theater, and it's spelled with an R-E rather than an E-R, which is important when you go to the website, because that's www.livingtheater.org. Again, this is playing from December 10th. Through January 30th for a sum which, like Dick Cheney's erstwhile location, is undisclosed on this show. But Wednesday night is Pay What You Like night, and it's Wednesdays through Saturdays in that December 10th to January 30th period. And we have also Anne Waldman, the notable poet and the author of this detective thriller, Red Noir, that Judith Molina is directing with us, the Living Theater.
And with that, I should mention that it's now 5 minutes after 1 o'clock in the morning on listeners, supported non-commercial, WBAI 99.5 FM. This is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. So I sort of felt like there was kind of a historical cycle that was closed when you revived the Brig a couple of years back. And
well, we also, there was a new production, of a 50th anniversary production, if you can believe it, of The Connection by Jack Gelber.
Tell us about that.
The Connection is sort of for us our classic play. It's a play about music and drugs and about the two kinds of high that you get from music and from
the two
drugs.
Kinds.
Two kinds of high, yeah.
Music and
it's drugs.
Jazz and heroin is what this play is about.
Jazz and heroin.
For ecstasy.
To be explicit.
And, we had a wonderful band. Freddie Redd and Jackie McLean, and when we revived it 30 years later...
50 years later.
50 years later?
Yes, 50 years later. Right, 1959, 2009.
And we had a wonderful band led by the son of Jackie McLean, Rene McLean, a wonderful saxophonist. And it's just very beautiful and very inspiring to see how the great suffering and madness of the heroine is somehow redeemed by the beauty and the high and the glory of the music.
And the jazz musicians are on stage and part of the plot because, in fact, the jazz musicians whom these jazz musicians are playing, who periodically break into jazz music, are like many jazz musicians of the 1950s, heroin addicts,
yes,
waiting
yes.
for their connection with the other people in the apartment.
Mm. So you say 60 years. So the Living Theater was really formed circa 1949, 1950?
Well, we have several dates that we have been using.
47,
I think, is the date that you and Julian first came up with the name. I've seen the... I wasn't
I think
there
was
and
before
you were...
That was before
okay,
that
well,
was before
when
that.
Did you meet Julian first?
We should say who Julian is.
Yes.
Julian Beck and I met, I think, in 1942. We were both, we were 17 and 18 years old or something, and we were two ambitious kids, and I had been studying with Piscator a very high art, a kind of very visionary theater, and I looked around and there was Broadway with its... that's one of the words I can't say.
there's a list of seven of them right here at the WBAI studio.
Yes, and Broadway with its nonsense.
Word number one.
We said the only thing to do is to start our own theater. Julian was an abstract expressionist painter working in the world of abstract expressionism. He was shown at Peggy Guggenheim's famous gallery, and all the artists were around, and we said, better a tiny little theater doing exactly what we want than to enter the world of the commercial theater. And so we started the Living Theater with a small group of anarchist and pacifist actors, and we've been struggling with it ever since.
It's now, we've got 20 minutes left. Should we perhaps do our...
Yes.
Yes.
Let's
we have, I think, another little number for...
remember to save something for the grand finale.
Maybe it would be nice to hear Anne read some of her own words from the play.
Please.
Okay, let's see. This is the child, Lucy does this part. There was a sound, and there was a sense of something sounding. There was a sense of it coming from inside, from outside, from all sides, and from all the voices in one's busy head. Whose? Hers. She said, I am sounding. Exactly, she said, sing loud and clear to compete with the birds, to compete with her bird self. There was an epistemological question about identity. There was something that couldn't be said about gender construct. The modern and opaque body, a rapt notion, wings you could hear beating on the invitation. What was sounding? Weapons! Not launched by the female ventriloquist, bombs, not hers. The war of this deprivation, a coil in flux turned back on itself, eating itself, core. And what is your helix? And what is your desire? What is the molten composition toward light? What is to be done? Rhythms of a blurred emotion? Snap it! Human, doll, object, the capital? Scorn! Iron will to carnage. I get used to it. The glee of power. Poor, poor puppeteer. Poor, poor, scanty scapegoats, less scared than a scarabaceous one. I think, therefore I situate, and sing the non sequiturs all over town. I am your scaramouche, I am your clown.
Bravo. Bravo, bravo.
And again, that's Anne Waldman reading her own work there. Live in the studio here.
Anne Waldman, playwright of Red Noir, a detective thriller. Brought to you by the Living Theater, opening December 10th through January 30th at their space at 21 Clinton Street. So probably a lot of listeners are familiar with the work that you did or still do up at Times Square. Every time there's an execution, you held
a long time we did that.
Performance vigil.
They won't let us do it in that space anymore.
Oh, really? They kicked you out?
The last time we did it, I got busted.
Oh, yeah. It's called Not in My Name.
Right.
It was a play against capital punishment called Not in My Name, since capital punishment is always done by the state in the name of the people, and we refused that dishonor.
Not in My Name.
Shall we do another...
I was thinking if we do the chorus. The chorus ensemble, and we can do our chorus ensemble.
Yes, good idea.
And we'll just go from.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, once again, remember, in 15 minutes, not even 15 minutes, really, you should have a big finale to go out with.
Yes, I think we have that.
Oh, we got that.
We would just jump from one into the next.
Beat in between each. Okay. Ready? Yeah. After this warning, solemn tumultuous, it's language at the margin. Collateral damage.
I see a world
where everything inhabits a container of steel. I see the demise of the space shuttle.
That's the atomic ensemble. What is dubbed the atomic ensemble?
Which is somewhat an all-knowing ensemble
in the play. So we come in and out. Actually, really only.
I actually have a request for Miss Anne to read, and
yes.
Of you know one of my favorite parts of the play of that I ask.
The very end.
Every thought.
Every thought is a tribe.
I don't want to say it all before you.
You know, I could wind up saying it right now. Just that's how much I love you. It's a very powerful part.
Every thought is already a tribe, the opposite of the state. The Joker's keys that could unlock the smallest trunk. Celebrityhood, as it swarmed over you, and you counted the ways you could be tortured.
I count them every day.
Exactly.
Yes. Yes. That's the point, I suppose.
And one thing that I love about this piece and just how much it's needed now. Just everything about this piece, and it's needed in today's world, and it's such a beautiful message, and it's needed.
Oh, you can hardly believe it if you don't come and see the play. So you really got to do that. The next step is to come down to 21 Clinton Street after the 10th of December and see what this is, what we're really talking about, because it's hard to talk about it even with the bits of song and chant that we can offer and the beautiful voice of Anne Waldman reading the poetry. It's unbelievable what happens in that little space and that runaround and with this wonderful ensemble that gives its whole spirit to this work. It's hard to believe, and you should come down and you should participate in it and be part of it, because if you are there, we will urge you to participate and be part of it.
And it's transcending. It's a transcending piece.
It's very interesting that the cast is from so many different places, so many other countries. Maybe you could say something about that. Some of the folk here. About the international cast.
Yes, well, this is a cast that's, I mean, we are all a very tightly meshed cast of living theater people, some of whom have been here from for years, decades, some of whom have been here for weeks now, a couple of months, and fit right in. Judith was saying to me on the second or third day of rehearsal, just after rehearsal, that it was just amazing to her how basically everybody who came to the casting call, which went out by word of mouth, and could make the rehearsal schedule, was in, and already they were working together as a real living theater group. And Garrick, her son, who grew up in this theater over the last 60 years, said after watching them work, you know, I think we have here much of the living theater for the next, you know, there are these certain periods where this whole new blood comes in, and I think with this play we're picking up a whole lot of new people for our future, a whole lot of great actors. But
Judith, you're the only one who's been around since the very beginning, right?
Yes, right. Mm-hmm. Right. But just to say, people from Slovenia, from Puerto Rico, from
Romania.
Italia,
Ondina here is from Romania, we should say.
I particularly want to thank Judith Malina and the Living Theater for giving me this opportunity to work with them, because as a foreign, and I only came last year in the States, it's very hard to do acting and theater, because pretty much, especially Broadway, they are very close for foreigners. So the Living Theater is really open to all the nationalities and, you know, to all experimental theaters, which I really love and which is really great for us.
So what other nationalities are represented in your cast this time
in
around?
This particular play, Puerto Rico.
Canada.
We have immigrants from...
Nigeria by way of Atlanta.
Yes, well, we have Eno Adet, who plays Bolt, the running man with the suitcase full of seeds, Azura, Blue Moon, Light of Jah, etc. He's from Atlanta, but his parents, in fact, are from Nigeria. And we have another actor, Shalene's parents are actually, well, his mother is from Africa, from Malawi, but on both sides of his parentage is, in fact, Gujarati. His father's from Gujarat in India and his mother from Malawi, but he's from Tennessee. I mean, this is a very mixed and at the same time very American cast, and we have Americans of many backgrounds as
Washington
well who were born
State.
Here. Yeah.
And across the aisle from me here is Enoch Wu, whose parentage is from China.
Well, my parents are from Taiwan. But, you know, I was born in Berkeley. It's a whole political propaganda thing, you know.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Right.
The whole
but I think we... Oh, and we...
China question.
We have Ruby from UK.
Ruby from England. We have Gemma Forbes from Scotland. And we have Celeste Moratti from Italy, as well as
Tiasha
from Slovenia. We were, yes, and mentioned Tiasha Fermi from
a truly
Slovenia.
International effort.
Yes,
and I, Brent Barker, claim no nation.
Yes,
like that on the record.
But it's,
right.
It's interesting. I and found since being here, people and knowing that Judith was doing a new play, it was going to be, and people have flocked back to New York to do this, not just from different countries but from other states. People have come especially to do this play, which is, and it's created a kind of a new center and an energy around the theater that people are just coming to.
Well, people
I
from
came
all
back from Italy to do it.
Yeah, yeah. People
I quit my job to do it.
People come from all over the world to see the Living Theater wherever. We have a branch, by the way, in Europe also, I have a daughter only because I wound up in the Living Theater and met somebody there who was from Venezuela and who would come to New York specifically to be with the Living Theater. So this is the way these things work. And my six-year-old is not even the youngest child whose parents met in the Living Theater, because Judy Reimer, who plays Crystal, the protester, the anti-meat protester, with her impassioned, beautiful, beautiful speech that Anne wrote.
It was the lines by Jack Kerouac.
Mm-hmm. And anyway, she has a toddler, a Matan, who is also another Living
Darling.
Theater baby, mm-hmm. who wouldn't be allowed around if his path. Judith hadn't created this theater for us all to meet with, so we really are. And in fact, Ruby, her aunt is married to the brother of two of our old hand actors from the last 20 years, mm-hmm. going back to the Third Street days 20 years ago of the Living Theater.
So, you
so
were,
it turned out
right,
she's
so
our niece.
You were on Third Street and Lower East Side for a while back in the 80s,
yes,
right?
Yes, we were. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm sorry to cut you off, but not only are we getting to act in this play and get all the connections that we are able to get and to learn and grow and have the love and the family that we've all created as a part of the Living Theater, but it's also teaching a class and it's learning history and it's being with a legend, and it's a living legend and someone who is transformed and changed theater as we know it. That and exactly, and we're actually to be able to sit in a room and it's really, it's awe inspiring. Just sitting in the room and watching and listening and watching everybody grow from the beginning, from day one, and just watching the growth of everybody is really it. And I've said that too. I've said that to you, Judith. That it's really, it's a pulse. That it had, the piece itself has its own pulse, which I guess any piece does, but there's such a life
and there's life within Red Noir. And there's
it's an anarchist pulse.
Right. Which is life itself, and that it's such a loving being within itself.
And when did when did Julian Beck leave the material world?
1985.
Judith has been, and at first with Julian, and then with Hannon, but continuing on again since the 40s, has been taking really dedicated, talented actors and turning them into anarchists and pacifists, and if we're really lucky, vegetarians. And in my case, I came along the other way, kind of as a committed anarchist, pacifist, vegetarian, showed up one day in 1997, and she's been spent the last 12 years turning me into an actor, which
all
pretty
right.
much proves
so
she can do anything.
So in the remaining 2 or 3 minutes that we've got left, why don't we say a few words about anarchism.
Wait, before we even do that,
yes.
Because how dare we? We have not even thanked Brad. And we haven't spoken about Brad, who was not here with us.
Yes, our assistant director.
Our assistant director, our friend, our mentor.
Judith's good
right hand, left hand.
Right head.
Wonderful
who
hand.
Who lends
to
a
all
modicum of
us.
Structure to our anarchist ensemble.
Thank you, Brad. Thank you,
Brad.
Brad who?
And we know that you're
Brad Burgess.
And Brad Burgess, who is such a gift to all of us.
Comes from Lowell, Mass. Near Lowell, Mass. Where
he is a New England fan to the core, and it takes a lot of love and anarchism to be friends with a Yankee fan like myself.
All right. Well,
now let's get back to what you were saying.
All right. Well,
sorry.
Briefly, because now we only have 5 minutes left.
Yeah, we want to do
you
our.
You still
want to
go out with your big finale? So we'll just play devil's advocate. And
from Greek, rulerless.
Let me just play devil's advocate and ask what anarchism, which sort of had its last big heyday in the 1930s. What it has to do with the world that we live in today?
The world that we live in today is in great peril. We're in a very precarious situation. We very well may destroy the beautiful world that we live in if we don't change the way we live in it. And the anarchists do have a history, a philosophy, and wonderful historical examples of where it's been tried, and where it's been tried, it always worked, because it's a much more sensible, more reasonable, and more humane way of organizing ourselves than the competitive forms, the hierarchical forms that we have been taught are the only way to live. And we would like to inspire people to know about the possibility of running things in a much more human way, of living a much more human and humane life. And I recommend the great writers, the great philosophers of anarchism, to your reading and to your research, because it ain't taught in the schools, but it still exists in the libraries and some of it on the internet, I understand, to examine this other possibility of organizing and of working together instead of working against one another all the time, the way all the competitive world teaches, the way all education teaches, the way sports prepares us for a competitive attitude. The word competition even is considered a beneficent word, instead of the horror that it is, that we should compete with one another instead of fulfilling each other. And the anarchist possibilities exist and are useful and possible and consist of not the vote, but the consensus, the possibility of bringing people to an understanding of each other's needs instead of fighting each other's needs. And, of course, we have conflicting needs, and learning how to resolve those conflicts in a loving and cooperative way. And this is
Buddhist anarchy.
And
Buddhist anarchy. I always say you sound so much like a Buddhist.
All right, with that, we should do our big finale. Perhaps we should mention first that this has been the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade with the Living Theater. When on hand, we've got Ann Waldman, who is the playwright of Red Noir, a detective thriller, which is going to be opening January 10th at the Living Theater at 21 Clinton Street between Houston and Stanton on the Lower East Side. Check them out online at livingtheater.org.
That's Living Theatre with an R-E.
Yes, with an R-E, the British way. We've also been joined by director and Living Theater founder, Judith Molina, and various other members of the cast whose names I will not belabor to mention one by one, but thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And why don't you guys hit it and take us out?
Cold noodle. Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.